Bueno, perdón.
Tenemos el honor y el placer de escuchar al profesor Edgar Aguilera, de la Universidad Autónoma de Nuevo México, y profesor aquí de la Universidad de Girona, un experto de Derecho Comunitario y Derecho Probatorio, asociación de probatorio, y que va a tener una ponencia, va a hacer una ponencia sobre estándares de prueba y límites del concepto de más allá de toda relacionada en el procedimiento penal.
Bueno, ¿se escucha bien? Thank you, Carlo, for that wonderful introduction. I would like to start by thanking all the people involved in the organization of this wonderful event. Of course, my BIAP colleagues and you, the members of the audience that invested part of your valuable time attending to this workshop. So in my talk today, I'm going to try to make a modest contribution to a project that some of us think it is worth pursuing, which consists in exploring alternative and hopefully better ways to articulate the legal standard of proof that is supposed to govern most of the factual determinations that a fact finder must make when she goes about deciding whether to attribute criminal responsibility to the defendant in the context, in the institutional setting that we have come to know these days as a criminal trial. Now, in a moment, the reasons why we need better ways to articulate this standard are going to surface. But before I get into that, I need to say very, very few general things regarding standards of proof according to legal conventional wisdom, which are the following. A standard of proof is one of the most important components of the structure of a judicial process, whether criminal or civil. Now, whether intended or not, setting in place a standard of proof and trying to correctly apply it to the cases brought before a court system has distributive effects on the factual errors or erroneous outcomes that, in spite of our best efforts to minimize them, which are normally absent, will remain being committed by the normal operation of the legal adjudicative machinery, if only on account of human judgment's fallibility, which, as we know, can be, to a certain extent, ameliorated or contained, but not totally erased from the picture. Now, the third thing I want to say about standards of proof in the legal domain basically has to do with its main function. The main function of a standard of proof is to provide a decision rule to the triers of fact that basically informs them when a guilty verdict or a finding for the plaintiff should be rendered. Now, in the context of a criminal trial, which is our main concern here, and for the purpose of having a very rough and preliminary analysis at our disposal, it can be said that this decision rule assumes the following form. Provided that condition X has been satisfied, you should convict the defendant, otherwise she must be acquitted. Now, at this point, it is only natural to ask what is the condition the absence of which would require an acquittal, and if satisfied, would give grounds to the trier of fact to issue a conviction. The answer to that question amounts basically to proving the defendant's guilt beyond all reasonable doubt, or BART for short, as I will be using the term here. Now, this, as you may know, happens mostly in Anglo-Saxon circles, but it has been also the case increasingly in elsewhere or in other regions less. Like, for instance, in many Latin American countries where the United States-inspired accusatorial model, as opposed to an inquisitorial one, has set the tone for the reform for the reform of those countries' criminal justice systems. Now, of course, the main task of the triers of fact, of criminal triers of fact, is not even as easy or even as mundane as this previous structure seems to portray. In fact, a brief overview on what certain legal sources have said regarding BART's content reveals that there's a lot of confusion surrounding this very keen notion. I'm going to go over three of the most important or more common interpretations of BART, just to have a picture, an idea of what legal sources say about its content. Is it? Yeah. So according to one interpretation, a belief in the defendant's guilt is a belief beyond all reasonable doubt if the confidence in his guilt is as great as the confidence a juror demands herself to have in beliefs underlying major decisions, major life decisions, say, for instance, getting married or accepting a job, maybe, or perhaps moving from one place of residence to another. Now, according to a second interpretation, and these are legal sources, I'm quoting, well, paraphrasing legal sources. According to a second interpretation, a belief in the defendant's guilt, changing a little bit the focus, is not a belief beyond all reasonable doubt. If the juror is hesitant to convict the defendant, that is, if the juror doubts that she committed a crime, but not enough to make her hesitant to convict, she should ignore that doubt and convict. This second interpretation goes back to Barthes' origins, where legal scholars of the time devised this notion of beyond all reasonable doubt in order to encourage triers of fact to convict more, because they were afraid that their souls would be lost because of blood hanging on their heads. So, but leaving that aside, a third interpretation of the Barthes standard says that, and this is very common and very, very close to the notion of conviction intima in our legal tradition, says that a belief in the guilt of the defendant is a belief beyond all reasonable doubt if, when having considered all the evidence, they, the juries, reach an abiding, firm, and unwavering conviction that the defendant is guilty. Now, of course, the main problem of these interpretations, as you might suspect, is that the brute psychological fact that a juror ends up his deliberation without having a lingering doubt in the defendant's guilt, but on the contrary, having a very abiding and firm conviction that she committed the crime she was charged with, may or may not indicate that the inculpatory hypothesis has passed epistemic tests that would warrant a well-founded belief that the accused committed the crimes she was charged with. In more technical terms, it would warrant that we took said hypothesis as true in the context of a criminal law, and therefore as an input of our reasoning processes leading to practical decisions such as convicting or acquitting. So, to wit, these interpretations seem to lack a specification of the kinds of inferences that would lead them, jurors, to a legitimate finding of guilt. So, the upshot of this interpretation, of this situation, seems that it would be preferable to have a standard of proof that provides more guidance by way of describing the features that a legitimate inference to guilt should exhibit, that focused on the structure of the arguments that jurors need to construct in order to arrive legitimately at a finding of guilt, rather than on the subjective confidence, such as it is done by those three interpretations that we went over just a second ago. So in the remainder of my talk, I will try to draw what I take to be the more important or the more salient lessons from some quests into other fields like epistemology and the philosophy of science, basically made by people with the interest to come up with a standard that would satisfy this condition of specifying the kinds of inferences that the jurors would need in order to legitimately arrive at a decision of guilt or of innocence. And in particular, I'm going to look at the attempt to flesh out Barthes' content in terms of an inference to the best explanation, also in terms of the exercise of an epistemic virtue that is called authority over our beliefs, and last but not least, cashing out Barthes' content in terms of, or similar to, the notion of the relevant alternatives account on knowledge. So a little word of caution for those of you having a very strong background in epistemology, philosophy of science, logics, and the like, the following is going to sound pretty basic, but I have no justification for that other than the fact that that's as far as my skills currently allow me to go, and I hope that your feedback will illuminate me and those of us trying to come up with a standard such as the one I just described, at least very abstract or generally, by your input into these fields that seem to be very relevant for us. So according to our first quest, what it means for to prove the defendant's guilt beyond all reasonable doubt, it means that to have established that the prosecution story satisfies the strictures associated to an inference to the best explanation, otherwise the accused or the defendant should be acquitted. Now, there you have a very basic general schema of the structure of this inference pattern, which is comprised of those propositions, premises 1 to 4, and the conclusion, which is found in statement five. Now, premise one, as you can see, identifies the salient facts in need of an explanation. Premise two identifies the set of hypotheses, each one of them explaining the facts. And according to premise three, those hypotheses have to be the result of a thorough search for rival hypotheses. Now, as you can see in premise four, it individuates one of those hypotheses as being the best according to certain criteria that we're going to go to look in a minute. And the conclusion is therefore that the hypothesis being the best among its multiple rivals is probably true. Now, sorry. I wish to draw your attention on the term best explanation in premise four, because it is a very, very hotly contested issue. Some, like Thagard, for instance, say that a hypothesis qualifies as the best explanation only if it is able to explain different kinds of facts, it possesses simplicity, it exhibits appropriate analogies with the known successful hypotheses, and if it strongly coheres with our background beliefs. Others, such as Josephson, for instance, say that we should take into account whenever we are trying to determine if a hypothesis is better than another or the best in the context of multiple rivals, the internal consistency of the hypothesis, its predictive power, how decisively it surpasses its rivals, and the thoroughness of the search for rivals. Now, these are not, of course, the only proposals in circulation, but I wanted to focus on them just to convey to you the message that we don't seem to have a consensus about what precisely is it that makes one hypothesis a better explanation than another, or the best in the context of multiple rivals. Now, for the sake of the argument, let us assume that such a consensus can be reached, or even that has been reached. Nonetheless, and here I join forces with Larry Loudon, the IBE model, IBE, it's short for inference to the best explanation, the IBE model ends up having these following problems. First, it runs counter to our supposedly deeply rooted intuitions regarding how robust a proof leading to the conviction of the defendant we want it to be. And the second problem is that applying the inference to the best explanation to the criminal law ends up running counter to the IBE model's original aspirations of constituting a universal standard of credibility, a universal standard of rationality of beliefs, instead of a tool designed or devised to measure the specific probatory force that certain evidential items provide to a certain conclusion. Now, zooming in a little bit into the first of those problems, it amounts to saying that the application of the IBE model to the criminal trials makes convictions too easy to come by. We get this effect on both the so-called best of a bad lot problem and the best of a good lot problem associated to the IBE model's unmodified versions. Let's zoom in a little bit into those problems. Now, in the former, that is in the best of a bad lot problem scenario, we have a defendant that could be convicted on the basis of a feeble attempt from the prosecution to prove her case. Or in other words, on the basis of a poorly plausible inculpatory hypothesis, though still stronger than the case for the defendant's innocence. To wit, this problem amounts to having to settle on the lesser of two bad explanations. Now, in the latter case, in the case of the best of a good lot problem, we have a defendant that, despite having a not particularly bad or a reasonably plausible story to tell, could also be convicted provided that the prosecution story has been established correctly as superior, even, and here is the source of worry, even by a little. Now, this feature, making convictions too easy to come by, runs counter to the deeply rooted intuition of Western contemporary societies that false positives in the context of criminal trials, that is, of course, false convictions, are way, way costlier than false negatives or false acquittals, which is why the former should be earnestly minimized in comparison to the latter. How? By taking certain institutional design steps. Those institutional design steps are to the effect of making a conviction precisely the opposite even makes of it, that is pretty hard to come by, And naturally, given that it represents the less costly category of mistakes, to the effect of making false acquittals the factual error more likely to be committed, which seems to be the price that we Western societies, as far as the official story go, are willing to pay in exchange of reducing significantly the risk of imposing to innocent people the adverse consequences that we have thought of initially as only applicable to the culprits. Now, setting in place a very demanding standard of proof is a key step in that direction, in that its high level of severity or of rigorousness, which is supposedly conveyed by Bard, is precisely meant to capture or to be sensitive to the previous cost attributions and distributing preferences pertaining to factual errors. Now, if you allow me, let's go back a little bit to the best of a bad lot problem. Some say we can get rid of it by simply saying that the IBE model requires the hypothesis at play to be minimally good or plausible so they can enter the competition to begin with. But getting rid of the best of a good lot problem has proven more difficult, if not impossible, on pain of fatally distorting the IBE model. Consider Paul Thagard's and Josephson's attempt of rescue. For instance, the former, Thagard, has suggested that we modified the IBE structure or the IBE model in order to include an additional constraint, which amounts basically to the prosecution's theory having to be not merely better, but much, much better than the story of the defendant in terms of their respective plausibility. The latter's, that is Josephson's proposal, is that guilt barred be understood as established when there is no plausible alternative explanation for the data that does not imply the guilt of the defendant. So within Thagard's framework, Bard has been translated into a gap sufficiently great that must obtain between the plausibility of the prosecution story and that of the defendant's story in order to get a conviction. But if this is the case, the juror ends up in the same situation that motivated looking outside the law for help, that is in need of someone telling her what Bard means, but only this time within IBE's territory, thereby making us ask why she should bother herself with all the nuances and subtleties of an inference to the best explanation in the first place. Now, for its part, Josephson's attempt seems more promising. Unlike Thagard's earlier modification, his does not require recourse to an independent, freestanding notion of proof beyond all reasonable doubt, nor does it require an inference to the best explanation at all. And that is the problem, at least for those wanting to apply the IBE model to the criminal law domain. But curiously enough, maybe not for those seeking more solid foundations on which to ground an adequate articulation of the Bard standard. We will come to that point at the end of the talk. Now, if on Taggart's view, the defendant guilt is proven Bard just in the case the inculpatory hypothesis is the only reasonable, if in Josephson's view, the defendant's guilt is proven Bard just in the case the inculpatory hypothesis is the only reasonable explanation of the facts, which in turn makes it irrelevant whether the prosecution story is better than its known rivals that likewise explain the facts of the case, what does this inferential pattern has to do with inference to the best explanation, since to have anything to do? In fact, we might call Josephson's an inference to the only plausible explanation model when viewed from the perspective of convictions. And in the case of acquittals, and very tellingly we might add, we can call Josephson's a reject the best explanation of the data model, so as long as there is an innocence pointing less good hypothesis on the table, and the latter being propounded by the defendant exhibits minimal plausibility. So why bother employing the IBE model if in its original version it makes convictions very easy to come by, which is something that we do not want or we do not expect, and if in its modified versions it suffers from roughly the same subjectivity deficits that affect Bard's common interpretations, I'm referring to Thagard's version, or has nothing to do with an inference to the best explanation, and here I'm referring to Josephson's explanation. Now, let's move forward to our second quest, to our second journey, trying to cash out Bard in terms of more plausible terms. It is a look into virtue epistemology. And here I'm going to refer to the very interesting project of Federico Priscinali that was here with us a moment ago and yesterday. And well, basically for Federico Priscinali, there's a better strategy to advise jurors on the correct meaning and the correct application of Bard that finds itself halfway between providing too little guidance, which would not be very helpful at all, and too much guidance, which would unduly influence the verdict and encroach on the triers of fact finder's role. We could imagine an example of the former, that is of providing very little guidance, by way of imagining a judge simply telling the jury that a reasonable doubt amounts simply to an assertion supported by reasons, which, as I said, would not be very helpful. And we could imagine an example of the latter, that is of providing too much guidance. If we imagine a judge indicating to the jury specifically the facts or the gaps of the case at issue that would constitute a reasonable doubt. Sorry. Now, what is the strategy Piccinelli has in mind? Well, basically it consists in reading into the Bard standard certain methodological directives that prescribe the endorsement and the practice of a certain epistemic virtue that someone engaging in an enterprise such as criminal fact-finding should employ. This is important. The characteristic expression of said virtue is promoting respect for the threshold embedded in Bard. Now, what is the epistemic virtue that Piccinelli has in mind? He calls it exercising authority over our beliefs, and it amounts basically to adopting what we might call the deliberative stance to the question or concerning the question, do I believe that P? So when someone adopts the deliberative stance, according to Piccinelli, she aims at making up her mind on whether she is to believe or not, and just at describing the contents of her mind, like for instance, experiencing a certain attitude towards a certain proposition or a certain mental state, like that of believing in P. Second, whenever someone adopts the deliberative stance, she treats the question, do I believe that P, as equivalent to, is P true? Now, three, so she is concerned with forming via her reasoning a cognitive attitude that is accurate. And four, therefore, she takes into account evidence that guides her in determining whether P is probably true. Now, another feature that we must highlight from Piccinelli's proposal is that authority comes in degrees. What I take he means by that is the following. There seems to be a sort of continuum flanked on one end by the agent's full adoption of the deliberative stance and on the other end by the agent's full adoption of the theoretical stance, which is that in which the agent is concerned only with detecting the presence of a certain mental attitude. Now, ideally, all the cases with a conscious effort to exercise this kind of authority would ideally lie at different points, all close, but some closer than others, of course, to the full adoption of the deliberative stance. So conversely, the closer the agent gets to the full adoption of the theoretical stance, which is the opposite to the deliberative stance, she progressively pays less attention to the existence of justifying reasons. She puts less care in her consideration and assessment of the available evidence, thereby creating the risk that her cognitive attitudes depart from the reality of their objects. And according to Piccinelli, this might happen because or under the influence of such factors as expediency, idleness, overconfidence, and bias. Now, applying this framework to the criminal trial, we have the following. So the fact finder should be virtuous in the sense of trying to fully adopt the deliberative stance concerning the question, do I believe that the defendant is guilty? Now, she will be able to come closer to that point the more authority over her beliefs she exerts, which on its turn basically manifests in a thorough assessment of evidential strength and reliability, which are, according to Piccinelli, two of the more important cognitive operations regarding what he calls the bread and butter of the fact finder. What is that he has in mind with this phrase? The making of a judgment concerning the occurrence of a fact based on a judgment concerning the occurrence of another fact. Now, Piccinelli gives us an example of how these operations would be carried out, and it is the following. If an expert claims that there is a match between an ear print found at the scene of the crime and the print of the defendant's ear, the fact finder is not to infer that the defendant was at the scene of the crime before assessing carefully, on the one hand, the strength of the correlation between the presence of a match and the fact that the two prints came from the same source. In other words, how likely is it that the source is the defendant's given that match? On the other hand, she has to carefully assess the reliability of the information used and provided by the expert with regard to both the presence of the match and the correlation. Here is a, the general schema trying to depict this example. Now, Piccinelli also thinks that it is possible to devise a clear and helpful instruction to the triers of fact that mentions the threshold required by Bard, but that concentrates in the main traits of the reasoning method discussed so far, basically in basically assessing the strength and reliability of the inferences made. Now, Piccinelli's proposal is consistent with leading virtue epistemology accounts, and particularly with some leading views pertaining to responsiblist proposals of virtue epistemology, for instance, like that of Jason Bayer's. On Bayer's view, answering to questions such as, what is 1 meter in front of me right now? Did I drive to get here? Or do my shoes pinch? Require little more than the brute or default operation of some of our basic cognitive faculties, such as perception for the first question, memory for the second, and introspection for the third. These cases may be considered as paradigmatic examples of immediate or automatic knowledge or justified belief acquisition. But responsibilists such as Bayer claim that character traits, as opposed to the previously mentioned cognitive faculties in good working order, are predominantly at work and therefore are the intellectual virtues that we should be concerned with when acquiring knowledge is or justified beliefs is harder, much harder to come by. Put in other words, whenever an active and intentional search for the truth about some empirical question is called for, careful observation, curiosity, attentiveness, impartiality, open-mindedness, and the like are conceived of as some of the generic demands that an inquiry makes on agents such as ourselves in order for it, for the inquiry, to be successful. More specifically, Bauer submits that there are at least 6 requirements or challenges of a successful inquiry, and that they can each be met or overcome by the inquirers possessing and deploying a set of intellectual virtues understood as character traits. So, for instance, one of those requirements is the requirement of being and maintaining motivated throughout the inquiry, which is, according to Bayer's account, met by the agents manifesting the right amount of wonder, contemplativeness, reflectiveness, and inquisitiveness. Another demand or another requirement would be that of being sufficient or properly focused, which is met, according to Bayer's, by the agents manifesting the proper amount of attentiveness, thoroughness, sensitivity to detail, careful observation, scrutiny, and perceptiveness. The third requirement, according to Bayer's, is that of consistency in the evaluation of different sources of information, which is met by the agents manifesting intellectual justice, fair-mindedness, congruence, objectivity, impartiality, and open-mindedness. And so the story goes. So as I said, 6 requirements, so 6 practical demands that an inquiry makes on cognitive agents such as ourselves. But then, Piccinelli acknowledges that the virtue of authority can be seen as an all-encompassing term containing all the virtues relevant to avoiding falling prey of biases and biases when inquiring some aspect of the world. Thus, authority could be used to refer to Bayer's whole list of intellectual virtues. We can start seeing the problem this suggestion gets us into, but even if he wanted to stipulate that authority refers only or mainly to assessing the strength and reliability of evidence, as I think Piccinelli would want us to, this seems to be the appropriate time of bringing forward the philosophical problem of the deep interconnectedness of intellectual virtues, which basically consists of the following. Now, unlike faculty virtues, character virtues, are reliable, that is, they have truth-conducive properties only when possessed in conjunction with other character virtues. For instance, open-mindedness, intellectual caution, or tenacity are unlikely to be helpful to reaching the truth if possessed in isolation. Now, the second claim is related to this interconnectedness problem, is that the possession of a single character virtue apparently can presuppose the possession of other virtues. So it seems that to be genuinely intellectually fair, for instance, one must also be intellectually careful, patient, which in turn seems to require that one be intellectually attentive and determined. So to sum up, the deep interconnectedness problem of character virtues generates additional questions that need to be addressed if we are to have a proper grasp of their reliability. So these are the following questions that remain being unanswered. To what extent and in what way are character virtues unified? Does the possession of a single intellectual character entail the possession of all the others? If not, which subsets of character virtues go together? How exactly are these virtues related to each other so that when and only when taken together they are reliable? Now, we seem here to have lost ourselves in the jungle of what some would consider pointless philosophical subtleties, but not so fast. I think that if we are seriously committed to a virtue epistemology framework, we should not dismiss this problem that easy. Mainly because, as I submit, a powerful case could be made that some of the inquiry-related intellectual virtues in Bayer's classification are themselves an indispensable part, or can be read also into the Bard standard, which is to say that they go together along with the virtue identified by Piscinelli of exercising authority over our beliefs. Consider, for example, at least the cases of open-mindedness and intellectual courage. The former, open-mindedness, seems pretty relevant because of its intuitive link to the presumption of innocence, and the latter because of the collective deliberation setting where the juror normally operates, in which, if she doesn't have courage enough, she could fall prey to the group's pressure to hastily reach a conclusion. Now, Bayer himself has advanced the following, some definitions related to these other virtues. For instance, an open-minded person is characteristically willing and within limits able to transcend a default cognitive standpoint in order to take seriously the merits of a distinct cognitive standpoint. Intellectual courage, on its turn, is a disposition to persist in or with a state or course of action aimed at an epistemically good end, despite the fact that doing so involves an apparent threat to one's own well-being. But, despite this effort in conceptual analysis, I think the following questions still remain. How exactly are these virtues that arguably go together related to each other? What part is done by what component of the cluster so that when and only when taken together they are reliable? Does the possession of these virtues presuppose the possession of other virtues currently out of our scope? Can we find reasoning pattern counterparts or translations to open-mindedness and intellectual courage just as we have done with the virtue of exercising authority over our beliefs? Now, leaving aside this deep interconnectedness problem, there are more problems in the horizon, I think. If my reconstruction is accurate, for Piscinelli correctly applying the Bard standard amounts basically to engaging with the evidence in a certain way. How? By identifying the empirical generalizations involved in and making possible each inferential step found in the prosecution's theory, and by assessing its strength and its plausibility. Sorry. One of the reasons Bard amounts to carrying out these processes according to Piscinelli is that Bard's formula itself makes explicit use of the terms reasonable and doubt. For Piscinelli, reasonable is a term that names the act of engaging not with any reason the juror might have, but with the the reasons that are capable of conferring justification, that is, with evidence. And the term doubt names the method that must be employed when engaging with it. Sorry. Now, of course, explaining this intellectual process, highlighting its main features, is without a doubt, a reasonable doubt for that matter, something very valuable. But if engaging with the evidence in such a way, as opposed to merely ascertaining that I am experiencing a certain mental state or cognitive attitude, is a result we get only out of reading it out of Bard, What are the triers of fact supposed to do in other legal domains, say, for instance, in a civil domain or in other type of trial where different standards of proof are set in place? Shouldn't they, in general, do precisely that too, that is, engaging with the evidence in a similar fashion? If we answer affirmatively to this question, and I think we should, then carrying out these cognitive operations, those involved in determining the accuracy of inferences from the evidence, would promote respect for the threshold embedded in Bard, yes, but also respect for the thresholds embedded in such phrases as the preponderance of the evidence and clear and convincing evidence, for instance, to mention just a few but pretty important standards in addition to Bard, which, by the way, are considered as lower or less demanding standards. If only because of the same reason Piscinelli reads this procedure of engaging with the evidence into the Bard standard, that is, because something having to do with processing the available and relevant epistemic reasons, that is, evidence, seems to be conveyed by those other phrases too. But also because from the beginning, Piscinelli himself had already recognized that the process of drawing ideally accurate inferences from the evidence, or as he puts it, the making of a judgment concerning the occurrence of a fact based on a judgment concerning the occurrence of another fact, is the bread and butter of every fact finder in the legal domain. There is, I think, though, another more powerful reason why we might read this general procedure, this engaging with the evidence in the way previously described, into all standards of proof. It is simply, but importantly, the effect we get from stepping back from the analysis of each particular standard of proof and enter the terrain of more abstract, more basic assumptions. There, we can adhere to, and I think we should, to the rationalist tradition of legal proof, the main tenets of which are those that any judicial process, including and for some mainly criminal procedures, aim at functioning as a genuine system of empirical investigation in the relevant aspects. That is, at fallibly discovering the truth of the matter at issue, truth qua correspondence with reality, and two, that requiring those acting in the capacity of triers of fact to engage with the evidence, with the available evidence, guided by the general epistemic principles that apply to all forms of epistemic or empirical investigations, is the most adequate means to do so. Most adequate in the sense of maximizing the probabilities that this end, that is, fallibly discovering the truth, will continually be brought into fruition. I submit we should adhere to this approach, to this rationalist tradition of legal proof, on pain of being inconsistent with the widely spread notion that the judicial process is a setting where legal norms and the consequences they prescribe have a preferential occasion to be correctly applied, precisely and ideally to all and only the instances of the factual requirements to which the imposition of said legal consequences was conditioned to, that is, only to the facts, as philosophers might call them, the true makers that become legally relevant. But even when we do this, that is, even if we adhere to the main tenets of the rationalist tradition of legal proof, it still does not get us that far concerning the problem of articulating the Bard standard of proof, or any legal standard of proof for that matter, in terms of the kinds of inferences that would legitimately lead to a finding of guilt or innocence, which are arguably different from, but not necessarily incompatible with, those cognitive processes identified already by Piscinelli. In other words, we seem to have identified what engaging with the evidence might mean, and still very roughly, because we could zoom in a little or much more on the structure of evidential reasoning. But when have the triers of fact engaged with the evidence sufficiently? When are the results of said engagement with the evidence good enough according to their context? These are the main concerns in need of an answer. Now, Piscinelli acknowledges that he has sidestepped answering the question such as how much virtue the fact finder is to exercise so we can instruct her accordingly. What is the extent of consideration and assessment of the evidence that Bard requires? When should the fact finder be satisfied with her tests of evidential strength and reliability? Nonetheless, he thinks this criticism is less significant than it seems, basically because for him, jurors would not receive information on those cognitive operations otherwise, and because receiving information by way of adhering to his directives would only have the effect of increasing or likely increase their performance as fact finders. I agree with Piscinelli that with the grasp of these directives at their disposal, the fact finder's performance is only likely to improve. But that ends up being, without a shadow of a doubt, a related but nonetheless different project than the one we, and I thought Piscinelli too, had originally set out to undertake, which is to shed light on the nature, on the specifics of the BART standard of proof, and not on the most basic layer of evidential reasoning that seems to underlie the application of any or almost any other standard of proof. And we aimed at that goal, so the triers of fact would not be left to their own devices trying to figure out what BART means, which seems to be exactly the place where they still are, despite the ground our journey has made us already cover. Maybe we have a little bit more luck with our third quest. Let us look into the so-called relevant alternatives account on knowledge. In our previous look into the attempt of using the IBE model, we saw that in spite of having nothing to do with this inference pattern, with inference to the best explanation, Josephson's suggestion was a promising path to explore. His suggestion, you might recall, was to conceive of guilt beyond all reasonable doubt as being established when there is no plausible alternative explanation for the data that does not imply the guilt of the defendant. That is why, from the perspective of a conviction, Josephson's model could be viewed as an inference to the only plausible explanation model. From the perspective of an acquittal, this proposal requires the trier of fact to reject the inculpatory hypothesis and thus to acquit the defendant, even when it is the best explanation among its rivals, provided that there is at least one minimally plausible innocence-pointing explanation in the table. Now, the reason why this sounds appealing, this Josephson suggestion sounds appealing, is because it intuitively seems to incorporate just the right level of rigorousness that we expect from the BART standard. Put in other words, its degree of difficulty appears to be along the lines of the hard epistemic test we want the inculpatory hypothesis to pass before the trier of fact legitimately detaches from the default or null or presumed standpoint, which is that of the innocence of the defendant. So in order to keep tailoring BART's epistemic garments, I think we can refresh or keep developing this Josephson's idea. I submit that we can do that by recourse to Professor Gardiner's proposal to adopt what I said before, the relevant alternatives account of knowledge. According to this framework, so the following condition is necessary for knowledge. S knows that P only if she can rule out the relevant alternatives to P. The alternatives or error possibilities component of this condition is comprised of the propositions that are incompatible with the target belief P. Them being incompatible is understood in the sense that if they obtain, the target belief P is false. These error possibilities, this is important, have a branching structure so that each alternative admits of myriad sub-alternatives, which for their part admit of sub-sub-alternatives and so on and so forth. The relevance component of the condition refers to the property of some of those error possibilities of not being susceptible to be properly ignored or disregarded by the inquirer, on pain of not being attributed with, in this case, knowledge of P, or as we will see, with having established a claim like P, for instance, to the relevant standard of proof. On her turn, the agent must be in possession of evidence that is able to rule the relevant possibilities out. This ruling out does not have to be infallible or conclusive. In fact, it couldn't be because of the error possibilities branching structure and the typical skeptic possibilities that the world came into existence just 5 minutes ago, or that we might merely be brains in a vat and the like, that could always be thrown in and be consistent with the evidence. That is why Gardiner sometimes say that these relevant alternatives or error possibilities must be addressed by the evidence in the sense of ending up being inconsistent with the evidence or too far-fetched, outlandish, or remote to be taken seriously and into consideration. Now, when applied to this framework to the legal domain, Gardiner uses it to give an account of three standards of proof that from lower to higher are the following: the preponderance of the evidence, the clear and convincing evidence, and of course, our stellar standard, BART. The progressive rigorousness of these standards lies in that each of them requires increasingly remote possibilities to be ruled out in the lighter sense of being addressed by the evidence. So they are conceived of as marking three concentric circles, which are thresholds of remoteness. The more remote the possibility, the more likely it is to fall within Bard's territory, unless it is too far-fetched or outlandish to be seriously taken into account. So in Gardiner's framework, a claim P is established to a certain legal standard of proof only if the evidence adduced rules out the relevant error possibilities. The relevant errors possibilities are those attached to the particular standard being applied. Now, this condition is to satisfy a standard of proof has very interesting, I think, ties with the notion of evidential weight in the Keynesian sense. How so? If we assume that a set of evidential items is weightier the more relevant evidential items it contains, and that, that an evidential item is relevant if it increases or decreases the likelihood of a hypothesis being true, the error possibilities associated to each standard provide a more specific reference point to carry out assessments of relevance and set a threshold of evidential weight themselves. But we might, leaving that aside, we might ask at this point, how exactly are those error possibilities attached to a particular standard of proof? Can they be attached to each standard in advance, or do they depend on the particular creative and imaginative skills of each juror and each jury? And here I join forces with Gardiner in considering that whether an error possibility falls within the province of a particular standard, and thus whether it has to be ruled out or addressed by the evidence, is in an important respect determined by the actual world, that is, by what society is actually like, or by what tends to occur. This feature amounts to a contextual component, which on its turn can be taken as an opportunity to carry out serious empirical studies in order to determine for instance, what is frequently the case or frequently true when litigated claims are more likely false. This seems very important because in certain jurisdictions or in certain countries, that a crime scene was tampered with, that crucial evidence was planted, that the police tortured the defendant or gave her an inhuman and or degrading treatment to extract a confession, that the police simply entered into case construction mode too fast without considering and following important lines of inquiry, that the defense counsel was incompetent, that the prosecution used junk science, for instance, or that the defendant was identified by an eyewitness unduly influenced to do so, and so on, may seem to be far-fetched or outlandish and thus disregardable alternatives. But in other regions, such as my country, I come from Mexico, and maybe some other countries in Latin American countries that on the surface have implemented an adversarial and accusatorial model of criminal justice, these error possibilities might not be that outlandish at all. On the contrary, they may be the rule instead of the exception pertaining to certain classes of cases and certain classes of defendants like women, immigrants, indigenous people, the poor, and so on. This empirical study, such as these, may be said to be in the lines of the naturalization of the general theory of evidence and of the general theory of standards of proof, which on its turn may reignite a research program similar to the one advanced by the so-called taxed regime of legal proof. The difference would lie in that we would be attempting to predetermine in advance. We would not be attempting to predetermine in advance the probative force that the triers of fact should give to each item of evidence, but we would be attempting to provide her, that is the trier of fact, with some guidelines about the most relevant and empirically based error possibilities that they should consider pertaining, as I said, to different types of cases. But maybe in the meantime, we can do better while we wait for those empirical research results. I think we could be better off if we follow the suggestions of some authors, some of which is Jordi Ferrer, of instructing jurors in the following sense. Proof beyond all reasonable doubt can be read as entailing the following: that the guilt hypothesis must be able to explain the available facts, evidence, or data by way of integrating them in a coherent account of the criminal event, which usually takes the form of a story or a narrative whose episodes are ordered according to chronological and causal considerations. That the most important and empirically testable predictions a reasonable person may draw from the guilt hypothesis must have been confirmed, and that all the plausible non-ad hoc and innocence-pointing hypotheses explaining the same pivotal facts, evidence, or data must have been refuted. That is, at least under a certain conception of refutation, the most important predictions a reasonable person may draw from each of these hypotheses should have been disconfirmed. Now, of course, this proposal does not fully dispel the uncertainty surrounding the mysterious phrase "beyond all reasonable doubt." Indeed, there will inevitably be some space for disputes to arise with respect to the status of the predictions that may be drawn from the hypothesis at play. For instance, is this particular prediction pivotal to the case, or is it just a peripheral or unimportant one? In other words, the rationalist tradition of legal proof is not in the business of producing an algorithm like an infallible instruction to substitute the excessively vague standards of proof such as Bart, but is in the business of reasonably reducing their hail of indeterminacy and of relocating our focus upon the features the evidence must have and on the intellectual operations the trier of fact should engage in when she goes about assessing the evidence, instead of chasing subjective mental states. But even if these efforts are successful with respect to this modest objective, articulating a particular standard of proof, ideally the job of the legislator, also ideally supported by legal scholars, and determining whether it has been met in particular cases, which is the job of the trier of fact, will remain being complicated tasks, where frontier cases somehow will have to be dealt with. So no recipe is foreseeable in the near, nor in the distant future, and perhaps no recipe is desirable. Muchas gracias.